The following presentation was recorded at the 1998 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
That was maximizing error. We don't want to do that. Maximize truth. And it wasn't very long until I quit checking papers for what was wrong as to giving credit for what was right. And I was surprised how many more people got right answers than wrong answers. The credit was for the right answers. I didn't want check marks all over my paper. I didn't want R's and red lines and stuff. No. If it was right, it was right. Now, the next part, if it was wrong, it must be corrected. I'll admit, I gave fewer questions. And sometimes I'd say to the girls, you do half the questions and the boys do the other half, and then we'll compare our answers. If it's right, all right. If it's wrong, make it right. On a true and false test, it was not just TF, 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 TF. If it was true, no problem. If it was false, make it true. And it worked. It worked. For me, at least. Zero in on what is right. There is a power in positive thinking. Especially to the child who's always been pushed down because he can't. Like one mother said to me at a parent-teacher meeting, I guess my boys will make out like that all their life because my brothers were that way in school. No, it doesn't have to be that way. I had a seventh grade boy one time had never read a library book because he was so busy doing just what he had to do. And of course, one of the rules of the syllabus there was they had one library book per year. Well, he had missed it. So I was all cocked and primed at parent teacher meeting to tell the dad, your boy won't be going to eighth grade because he can't just do it. But his dad got me first. He was all beams and he says, Brother Tucker, I'm glad he's going to eighth grade. None of my family ever got a chance to do that. And he said, he's a boy. What did that do to my argument? He went to eighth grade all right. He did all right. We found him some reading material and we got him started. I know seventh grade's pretty late, but if it hasn't happened before, there's time then. Or if somebody's made fun of because of their family or because of their clothes or because of their color, if that's the way it is, there are blocks to learning and the teacher must somehow get around this. If you were ever the blunt end of someone's ostracism, I'm not going to say just or unjust, but at least if you were the blunt end of it, or you were the wrong side of the road or wrong side of the district, you know, if you ever felt that, then what must you think this little child feels like who has to be here because the law says he has to be in school and my parents put me here? Or like my wife's father experienced, maybe some more of your parents or grandparents, he couldn't understand English and goes to first grade. And what's a little Dutch boy supposed to do in first grade in an English school? Is it any wonder that all his lifetime reading was difficult for Papa? Reading was difficult. And I think a lot of it had to do with the way he was introduced to it in the first grade. Scientific thinking must penetrate the whole curriculum. There's no magic pill that you can give to a child, and he's going to automatically learn in English and social studies and science or whatever else just by that pill. It doesn't work. There's a certain process. We go from the known to the unknown. We go from the simple to the complex. That's the only way we ever learn. We go from what we know. Based on what we know, we reach out and learn more. We go from the simple to the complex. It's not enough just to chew up the material and feed it to a first grader. It must be understood even after it's chewed up. We must be able to see ourselves the correlation between all the subjects, and then the child can get that idea too, especially those of you who have the same children several years, teach several different subjects to the same children, and so on. In many ways, that's a very decided advantage. In other ways, it's not. That's debatable. How much hands-on experience do you really want the child to have? If we say that this experience thing is what we really need, how much of that do we want to have? Are you willing to risk yourself to do the homework necessary to provide for this? Now, someone says, well, we don't have the curriculum built up like that. We don't have the material. It's amazing. It's amazing. In our day of recycling, what kind of junk you can use for science class, especially. One of the things are these charts. These are inexpensive charts. For example, here's some freebies that came from Chevron, I think it was, some chemical company. Try to take care of your tomatoes. Well, that's very interesting. A lot of people grow tomatoes, but to look at it as an item in science or item in social studies. Same way with creepy crawly critters. Harmful insects. Now, this company is selling insecticides. If you're not one of those people who use insecticides, you'll have to forbear with me on that. That is a freebie. Another one's good, from the same company, explaining the life cycle of many insects. Complete metamorphosis. And to some people, this is difficult, really difficult. But a chart like this can help you quite a lot. That kind of thing. You can get material from grocery stores where they have displays for vegetables and fruits, meats and so on, especially for the four major, so it used to be seven, now it's four major food groups, and that can apply, especially if you're talking about nutrition. Well, how much hands-on experience are you willing to tackle? If somebody comes to you someday and says, hey teacher, what makes popcorn pop? Are you willing to take the challenge and say, let's try it and find out what we can? We'll do some research, we'll pop some popcorn and take a look. And be sure you notice when you pop popcorn, there's a moisture collects on the lid of your popper. Be sure you notice that. That has something to do with the popcorn popping. Are you willing to tackle that one? It's not a hard one. Now, I prefer to do it in a pan or something than in the foil things. Everything's all enclosed. And that's more like a trip to the zoo and you get your cotton candy while you're there. But we're not talking about an entertainment thing here. It's a learning thing. It's answering a question. It's finding out about things. As I said, we must go from the simple to the complex. A great question I've had to ask myself already is, what is simple to the child? What is complex to the child? I think it sounds pretty simple. Really do? I told my seventh graders, by the end of this quarter, we're going to have a test. And the first four questions are these. Point number one, a list of 25 mammals. Point number two, a list of 25 birds. Point number three, a list of 25 fish. Point number four, a list of 25 reptiles and amphibians. And all the groaning and the moaning. Well, I had a few things to help them. For example, on the matter of the reptiles, I had something to help them get started. On the matter of the fish, from the United States government, these are mollusks. The fish thing is, they weren't studying mollusks. Actually, I think not only are these attractive, they're informative. See what I mean? And you say, well, why in the world, Brother Tucker, did you expect them to know that? Well, that was the easiest thing to do. The internal structure of fish is much more complicated than just knowing 25 fish. The internal anatomy of a bird, which we studied in 10th grade, is much more complicated than knowing 25 birds. I said, let's start with the ones you know. What birds do you know? Well, sparrow. Okay, do you know what kind of sparrow? Why? Well, let's look in the verb guide. You'll see there's a bunch of different kinds. What kind do you know? Well, it wound up, it was the English sparrow. That was the one that was around the farmyard, you know. One boy even caught some and brought them to school so we could look at them. That was on his own initiative. I had parakeets in the classroom so we could look at birds and observe birds. Paid 50 cents a piece for them from a local parakeet breeder. I finally had to get rid of them because another class used my room and the boys threw paper wads at them and got that teacher all upset because the parents wouldn't keep quiet. Well, that was a lesson in learning, all right. It was a lesson in learning that boys know how to throw paper wads when their back is turned. What is simple to the child? What is complex? I thought that sounded pretty simple. You know, learn 25, these were seventh graders, learn 25 birds. Do you think that's simple or complex in your thinking? I think that's about as simple as you can get. More complex than that is the next step. What is the difference between a bird and a fish? Between a bird and a mammal? Between a bird and a reptile? You understand me? That's more complex. Because as far as I know, the birds are the only warm-blooded animals that incubate their eggs and have hard shells and so on and all that stuff. And besides their nice little feathers. And if any of you have a problem with allergies, sometimes these feathers cause problems. I don't know whether they do to the birds or not. This is just an example. A more complex concept than the difference between birds and fish is what's their structure. Now, basically, they have the same amount of bones, about 305, give or take a little. They're arranged a little bit differently. Practically the same amount of muscles arranged a little bit differently. And the evolutionist has a quite interesting time getting these all lined up in some textbooks and shows you how we evolve from each other. That's very interesting because those similarities are more just on the surface than real. Call the muscle what you want to. If it does something for a bird, it doesn't do for you. It's a different muscle. The function is not the same. Then a more complex thing of that is the internal structure of a bird, like I said. And you'll find out, studying a bird, that his intestinal tract is about 5 times the length of his body. You'll find out he has no teeth in his mouth, but he does in his gizzard. And a number of other things are very interesting about birds, especially after Colonel Sanders went bankrupt 5 times and then he found out he could fry chicken and became a multimillionaire at the age of 80. Chicken is a very interesting bird, isn't it? Yeah. More complex than that is to incubate some eggs. And if you're very careful, you can make a little window in there and you can watch that little chick develop. That's very nice. I don't think I do this with first and second graders. They might go home next morning and say, "Hey, Mom, I see this little speck in my egg. I think it's a little chick." They're liable to do that because I've known some boys that would have done that. Yeah. Like one little boy said, "Chickens are the bestest birds. Eat them before they're born and after they're dead." He liked them. Well, anyway. The whole life cycle can be very much more complex. Then in addition to this, you add the whole life cycle, the whole lifestyle. Study the Arctic tern, for example, and his trip from the Arctic to the Antarctic. Or the little hummingbird. I'm thrilled with the hummingbirds. They fly to Brazil over winter, you know. They'll be leaving now in a couple weeks. Their first fledglings are feeding and fussing and fuming. And they'll be leaving after a while. But you find out about them. Now, how do we find out? Well, most of us are not bird banders ourselves, but we take the information of bird banders, which are scientifics. They follow a scientific method of studying the life cycle of the bird. We have a gentleman in Cumberland who does that. He writes regularly in the newspaper about his bird banding. We had a bunch of mallard ducks at our place one year. 119, I think, hatched out. And I quietly robbed the nest and raised all the little ones in pens, which was illegal in our state, but I wanted to keep away from the cats and the foxes and the coons and whoever else. Well, one duck was special. You know there's a genetic trait in ducks and chickens that the wing feathers turn up at the end instead of down. Well, she was one of those. She could fly, but she'd come up at the barn when we did our milking in the morning. She'd dabble around in the manure in the barnyard and crawl under the nest, under the mangers and stuff. Well, one day she came up missing. Didn't think anything about it. Next spring, she is back again. She hatched a clutch of eggs on a bale of fodder. And one day she got killed on the highway. Well, then I saw the band on her leg. I sent the band in to the place, the address at Laurel, Maryland. And they said this bird was banded at the eastern shore of Delaware on such a date by such and such a person. Well, I knew where that bird hatched, and I knew where it came for a couple summers. It came back, and that's where it died. Well, that gave us information about that bird. And that's a rather complex thing when we work out a life cycle of an animal. And I'm using birds there because they're some of the easiest to understand. Some of the easiest to understand. They come and they go. You can provide nesting material, provide food for them and water for them, and they'll be there. Maybe some of you have a martin house, do you? Or put up gourds. Or maybe some of you have chimney swifts over the summertime. Or tree swallows. I was visiting a Mennonite school for a nature hike here this spring, and their bluebird house was occupied by tree swallows. And it was very, very, very nice to watch them. They're very beautiful birds. Well, and at all levels, now I'm using birds for an example. Take plants for an example, if you wish. I'm rather prejudiced to living things as over studying just mineral kingdom. However, a study of rocks and minerals is intriguing. Study of fossils is intriguing. Absolutely fascinating. Any questions at this point? What is simple and what is complex for the child? That you have to work out. And don't be surprised, ladies and gentlemen and others, if you're very brilliant with an IQ of 135 and little Johnny in second grade's 145, he'll let you know it. You must work with that. Use with what God gave him to work with. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, but you can make something with what God has given the person. And that's our job as a teacher. To find out, to research, to study, to know ourselves, to know our material, and to know our pupil. I don't know if Brother Mullet emphasized this or not in your child development. He perhaps will. I don't mean to steal from him, but there are three things that all human beings need, and if they don't have them, they will starve, absolutely starve. The first one is affection. The second is acceptance. And the third is achievement, the triple A. Acceptance, affection, achievement. It's up to the teacher to see that every Johnny, Billy, Susie, Rumpelstiltskin, whoever he is, see that he has all three of those things in the science class, in the spelling class, at lunchtime, on the playground. Any questions on anything I've covered so far? As I said a while ago, Dr. Bagley included in his law of learning meaningful repetition. What does that mean? What does it mean to have meaningful repetition? Well, I think the matter of, like I said, making 25 lists of birds, 25 lists of frogs or reptiles or whatever, or flowers, or collecting 25 stones. One of the boys in my class one time took baby food jars and he collected all the soil types on his farm. He got the county soil map and he collected one of each type and made a little report on what that kind of soil it would do. That was in general science, seventh grade. All right. What is meaningful review? When does it cease to be meaningful review and become mere repetition? Well, I think you have a hint at what I said about my Tucker's famous method of teaching spelling. The meaningful review means you always compare with the correct word, never with the one you've written just in practice. Always with the correct word. Meaningful review must be based on what you're trying to prove. I guess you're all familiar with the disease called epilepsy. A person who's epileptic is one of those persons whose brain may work very well, But when it gives a command, it doesn't quit commanding. It just keeps on commanding. Well, that's not meaningful repetition, because finally the individual falls into a spasm of some sort, because his mind keeps on stimulating and stimulating and stimulating. Or you're familiar with cerebral palsy? In that case, the brain gives out a command and it doesn't go where it's supposed to. Like it doesn't go to, the brain commands the hand to pick up something. It doesn't do that. The other hand may swipe it. I was visiting the school for the deaf and blind in Stanton, Virginia. And a blind student there had cerebral palsy, and they were making something in their shop. And he had it just about completed. And he went to pick it up to show us. And he crushed it. And he couldn't help it. The defeat was, it was terrible. But there's nothing he can do about it. You must be prepared to help any student whose brain is commanding, but it's not coming out that way. You say, what does that have to do with teaching science? Listen, it has a lot to do with teaching science, because, as I said, scientific method carries into all of the school. The girl who was in my grade in third grade, she had that problem. And in the morning, we'd stand for the Lord's Prayer, salute the flag. We didn't, but they did. And she would put her hand up and salute the flag, then she couldn't quit. She'd keep flag until she passed out. Well, it's not a time for ridicule. It's not a time for snap out of it. It's a time for knowing. Now, when in my teaching am I just repeating something? And when is the review meaningful so the stimulation I give prompts the right reaction, the right learning sequence? In other words, am I making it more difficult for the child than easier? Could the child learn better without me than with me? You are aware, aren't you, that you have and I have learned many things not because of my teachers, but in spite of my teachers. Maybe you remember some cases like that right off the bat. Now, we have to understand that. So if we're going to have meaningful repetition, it's not just a matter of writing these words 25 times, or like myself, stand in the corner until you can say the threes table right. That was a terrible place. That's a lonely place in the world, I tell you, especially during playtime. I learned my multiplication table standing in the corner. I have a narrow view on life, I tell you. That's a bad. Do any of you know that experience? Well, I don't know why that was a problem to me. I don't know why math was a problem to me. I really don't. But it was. It was a terrible thing. But to my teacher, it was a dream. You know, just do it. Just do it. Come on, Tucker, just do it. You're not working up to ability. Meaningful repetition comes when the idea gets through to the person that's supposed to be learning it. And it's not like an epileptic shock or cerebral palsy just scatters over his brain and goes everywhere else. Now, boys are put together a little bit differently than girls are on this matter. I think psychologists will bear me out on this. There are certain ways of thinking, certain ways of reacting to stimuli that are different. Part of this is because of training. A nice little girl does this, a nice little girl does that. That's, you know, that kind of thing. And another part of it is because of the hormone structure of our bodies. That's a little bit different. But part of it is also, it depends whether you have a male teacher or a female teacher. And sometimes a girl can learn better from a male teacher. And sometimes a boy can learn better from a female teacher. It happens. Especially grades 1 and 2, where he sees in the teacher a mama figure. Would it embarrass you if a second grader came up to you and said, Mama? Or a first grader, hey, Mama? Or hey, Daddy? To the, well, I've had that happen a lot of times in school. A child would come up and say, hey, Dad, so and so and so and so. More times it was Uncle Dwayne, because my wife had a lot of nephews and nieces in this school. And of course, now if I were in the classroom, it'd be Grandpa. There are some people who think this degrades from the dignity of it all. But the point is, are you getting through to the child? Is he learning from you as Uncle Dwayne or Grandpa or Uncle or Grandma? Or does something happen that turns him off and he doesn't learn the rest of the day because he was embarrassed by your reaction? Meaningful repetition has to have built right in it this acceptance, affection, and achievement idea. The teacher's objectives for learning must be obvious. He must know why he's doing it and somehow get that through to the child. Another problem that faces... By the way, are there any questions at this point? Are there any here from New England states that are of their contrary opinion? The land of the otherwise minded, as they say. Maybe I'm off on left beam. I think I'm correct on this, but I'm willing to stand challenged if you have something to say. You have a problem with the idea of laws and principles in science. Some people say it's a law of nature that's so-and-so, or it's a law of science that's so-and-so, or men are taking too much on themselves to make laws like this. Well, I'd like to explain that just a little bit. One of the things is this, that these laws are not made, like the law of gravity, for example. The law of gravity is not made to make things fall toward the earth. The law of gravity is made to explain why things fall toward the earth. There's certain law of inert gases. They didn't make the law like you make a speed law or a law to control jelly making in Pennsylvania. A law like that, they didn't make a law to control that, but on the basis of what they observed. Principles of science are what usually happens. For example, it's a principle in science that ice usually expands when heated and contracts when cools, usually. Sometimes it evaporates when it's even cold. Well, it's evaporating at all temperatures. Water is evaporating at all temperatures. It just happens that under certain circumstances it may not behave as you expect it to. Certain temperatures, ice does not expand, and then several degrees later it does. It's very, very strange how ice behaves itself. Or the matter of glass is another one. Glass is a liquid, as you know, or maybe you didn't know. We usually think of something solid like glass as being a solid, but glass is a liquid, and all it do, you change the temperature, and you soon prove that. Now, what about a theory in science? We talk about laws and principles. A law is what almost always happens. That's almost foolproof. One of them is, for example, the law of motion. A body at rest tends to remain at rest unless acted upon by an outside force, in the law of physics. A body in motion tends to remain in motion unless acted upon by an outside force. Newton's laws have to do with motion and thermodynamics. And one of these we use very much in our teaching of creation science, and that is that whatever comes out of a reaction is not always equal to what went into it. So the world is running down. The laws of thermodynamics underscore that. Now, a theory, we'll say like the atomic theory, the smallest unit of matter is an atom. Well, they've recently discovered something that's smaller than the protons and neutrons and so on, which were the smaller than the atom. That is being modified by physicists now. But the one that causes us the problem is the theory of evolution. Does that scare you if someone gives you some material or it comes through the mail or you pick up an encyclopedia? I'll tell you why I'm not scared by it. Maybe I should be. But I'm not scared because I understand that Mr. Darwin, to whom the theory is credited, believed in creation. And also, the man who propounded his theory, Mr. Lyell, then later on, the Huxleys, who made it popular, they out-Darwined Darwin in what he said. The theory was his ideas on the subject. Now, where I run at odds with Mr. Darwin was, there was a German monk named Gregor Mendel in Austria performing some important experiments in the 1800s. that disproved what Mr. Darwin observed in the Galapagos Islands off the coast of South America. But Mr. Darwin didn't know anything about Mr. Mendel's laws of dominant recessive traits and assorted characters and all that. Later on, the geneticists came up with the idea of chromosomes and genes and all of the characteristics by which things are inherited. Darwin didn't know anything about that. His theory was his best explanation, his hypothesis at the time. Now, the problem is there's a difference between science and scientism. Are you aware of that? A difference between science and scientism. Scientism is a worship of science. It can't fail. It can't be wrong. Darwin said so and so. Lyell was a lawyer, by the way. He's the one that came out with a geological table that what's down the farthest is the oldest. So they date the fossils by the rock that's in them, and they identify the fossils by the rock that's around them. It doesn't make sense. It's the only time in science where circular reasoning is permitted. Well, those theories are just ideas. Don't let them scare you. You might have a theory that the world is resting on a cherry pie. And the cherry pie standing on the top of four hippopotami. And the four hippopotami on four rooster's heads. I mean, you can have a theory if you want to. The theory that the moon's made out of green cheese or Camembert cheese if you wish. I don't care. You can have that theory. But the theory must line up to facts. And Mr. Darwin didn't have the facts. He based his ideas on a species of finches found in the Galapagos Island that looked very much alike, but they were different species. Oh, I have you there, Mr. Tucker. A man just told me this the other day. He said, just look at all the different kind of cattle that have evolved. Well, what kind do you think when Adam first said that's a cow, if he said a cow, what kind do you think it was? Do you think it was a Jersey or Guernsey or Brown Swiss? No. It was a combination of all those factors. It's just like Adam himself. What kind of man do you think Adam was? The word means red man. Adam and Edom are the same word in Hebrew. You think he was like you, like me? Fair cheek, rosy skin? No. He was a dark man. I don't think he was coal black, but I don't think he was white either. But all the genes of all the human race was found in Adam and Eve. If I believe Genesis, if I believe the earth is the Lord's, then I accept that. Now, if not, the matter of assortment of kinds of dogs, kinds of chickens, kinds of cows, kinds of cats, that's assortment of the original genetic makeup. That's not hard to explain. All you have to do is be a farmer and know something about hybrid seed corn, and you can find out how these changes are made. So if it's a problem for you about the use of laws, theories, principles in science, they are not like the Ten Commandments that we bow to. They're not inspired by God. These are men's attempts to answer from their point of view what they see in the world around them. Well, it's soon time to close here. Are there any questions at this point? One more thing, and then I think I'll close. I know there's plenty of time, but if you're worn out, I'm not quite, but I don't want to get that way either. Somewhat reviewing and at the same time pulling in some loose ends, how do we learn to learn? How do we learn to learn? Do you remember anything I said today that would apply to that subject? Anything anybody else said? How do we learn to learn? Pardon me? Okay, observation. But then, our observation must have some orientation or it won't quite make sense. Will it? You know the story of the five wise men of Hindustan who met an elephant on the road one day? Now they had five different distinct observations. One was, they're all blind, you know. So one says, oh, I know an elephant, it's like a wall. He had bumped into his side. Another one grabbed his leg and said, oh, I know, he's like a tree. No, he's like a snake. No, he's like a rope. One had the smooth touch. No, he's cool like a rock. All were partly right and all were exactly wrong. And that's our problem with observations. Now, how's a teacher going to help a student have the proper observations or draw the proper conclusions from the observations? How do we learn to learn? Your answer is correct. But I'm raising this other question because you might see some phenomenon, like we'll say a meteor flies through the sky or an eclipse. You might observe it, and I might observe it, and I might fall to the earth in terror. And you try to find out what it is. See the difference? This is what goes on in our world, isn't it? Observation is important. But remember, there's orientation to our observation. John Burroughs, the great naturalist, when someone asked him, how do I teach my child to appreciate nature? He said, turn him loose in the woods and trust to luck. Would you tackle that one? Just turn a child loose in the woods and trust to luck? What about turn him loose in the library and trust to luck? So you're right. Observation is very important. But remember, you must orient the observation. It must be for the purpose of your stated objectives. I'll give another example. You might be studying, we'll say, temperature changes. Now, here comes a child to school, and he's all keyed up about, say, something else. Let's say rockets. Well, you're not studying about rockets. But he keeps wanting to butt in and say, you know, a rocket does so and so and so and so. Yes, yes, but we're studying about temperature changes here. Why is it colder in your bedroom in the morning than it was in the evening when you went to bed? Why is it that we turn up the thermostat to change the temperature in the room? What does the thermostat do with it? You know, and some science books have some very interesting little questions like that. Now, how do you apply that to this little guy who wants to talk about rockets? Well, if we're talking about heat exchange, we can also talk about heat exchange inside of a rocket too, can't we? At least get him off the hook for a little bit. I'm not saying trump him down. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is orient the observation so that it applies to the objective that you stated for the lesson. And you should know that. All right, what else can we do besides observation? Learning to learn. Experience. And that's put in the child's experience. I think it's always best for the teachers to try their demonstrations and experiments beforehand. I know some teachers have never studied science, and yet they're asked to teach science. It's like a young man came to me one day and asked about some algebra problems. I said, what's thus all this thusness? He said, I'm going to teach algebra this fall. I said, did you study algebra? He said, no. He's going to teach algebra. Now, there's some catching up necessary there, really. So experience is going to be, first of all, the teacher's experience, right? And then, again, it must be used in light of the stated objectives. What do you want this course to do? What do you want this class to do? Will this experience make it easier to learn? Will this experience confuse matters? The teacher has to weigh all of that very carefully. But again, the hands-on is a much more valid learning tool than the lecture, because the hands-on leads to experience. Any other thing? There's two other words I've used repeatedly this afternoon. I was hoping someone would feed back to me. Maybe I'm not getting across. Stated objectives. What does that mean? Stated objectives. Somewhere, the teacher must know what he's trying to do, or he'll be like the fellow who aims at nothing and generally hits it. And I'm sorry to say, but some science teachers do it this way. They just aim at nothing and generally hit it. And no wonder people say it's a waste of time. If the teacher didn't have stated objectives for himself, what are the desired outcomes for this lesson? In other words, what will be different when we're finished than it was when we started? I certainly hope we're not more ignorant, wouldn't you think? I certainly hope that we're a bit more understanding, a bit more knowledgeable. If when we're finished, we don't know as much as when we started, my dear friend, that's a losing game. The child's getting older. The child's going to look. He's going to see. He's going to hear. Now, what we do as a teacher is to be beneficial, it must be according to what we want to happen for that child. Anything else? Review. Meaningful review. Meaningful repetition. Here's a place for drill. Some people don't like the word drill, but it's a good word if it's meaningful and useful. And some things, like the multiplication tables, you may just have to drill till you get them. You may be. Why is it today's 2 times 2 times 3 is 6, and tomorrow 6 times 1 is 6? Why? Never mind, just learn them. That's not the way out. You're right. Meaningful repetition. Anything else? Yes, ma'am. Raising questions. Yourself and taking advantage of the questions of the pupils. Some of those are very interesting. My daddy says, you think? Don't get yourself between this little boy and his daddy. I ran into one of those one time when he said, my daddy says you're fat. I said, you tell your daddy he's right. I mean, I wasn't going to get in between there. So sometimes we have to use a little diplomacy there at a time like that. Save your hide. But you're right. Utilize questions. Ask questions. What about the matter of testing? We haven't discussed that today much. Just hinted at it. Anyone have any proposals here? May I suggest one for science class? Always use new tests for each testing period. Use old tests for review, but make a new one for what you're covering currently. That's good for social studies too as well and other subjects. Always use new testing material. This is one of the problems I have with just the workbook method and with some self-directed study that if they manage to get Big Sister's textbook where they have the answers, whether they knew what it was or not. I don't like that. And if they ask you for true and false tests, give them to them. But then work it as a learning technique. Don't grade a test and just throw it in the wastebasket. Review, review, review. Anything else? There also is a place for the teacher to have a tender heart. Without the teacher loving the pupil, loving her job or his job, loving the material, couching it with what can be done to help the child, without that, we're wasting our time. We're dealing with human souls. This is different than building little barns or building trusses or rafters. Those you can cut the shape, everything pretty well fits. But as far as pupils are concerned, They are the way they are because God made them that way. And we must work with them. I want to thank you for your patience this afternoon, your attention. I hope that you all are blessed in your teaching this year. And if you're not teaching, maybe you'll consider it. Thank you. Any other questions? You're welcome to come look over any of the material I brought along here, or the books I brought if you want to examine.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.